Some who ask if any good can come out of the Fraser Valley in Abbotsford, so I'll hopefully today I'll demonstrate that a few things good can come out of Abbotsford in the Upper Fraser Valley. Topic: George Grant and Charles Taylor. What I'm going to do is, some people would argue, following Alfred North Whitehead, that philosophy is really the footnote to either Plato or Aristotle. What I'm going to hopefully point out today, that it's really the footnote to history is the footnotes to Plato or Hegel. And in many ways, George Grant represents historically the turn to Plato and the classics and what they stand for philosophically, politically, theologically. And Charles Taylor is very, very much a child of the Enlightenment, the complex nature of the Enlightenment. I'm going to look at that also. This is probably why Charles Taylor has been given the Templeton Prize, another thing he very, very much plays into the spirit of the age in a sophisticated, not a silly way, and we're going to have to unpack how he does that. So what I'll do first of all, I'll go over some of Grant's key ideas. George Grant was considered probably the leading Canadian intellectual of the latter half of the 20th century. And certainly Charles Taylor is one of the most impressive and important Canadian intellectuals today. So we're dealing with two really Mount Bakers of thought, as they have, they never squared off intellectually with one another. And I brought a letter from Taylor. He wrote to me in 1995, in which I asked him a couple of questions about really the premises he's emerging from and if I understood his thinking correctly. And he replied that I'd sort of caught it in a nutshell perfectly. And when I move transition from Grant to Taylor, I'll just look at I'll look at what he's trying to defend and what, in fact, he's an apologist for. George Grant. George Grant was born 1918 and died in 1988. So this year is an important year. There's all sorts of conferences being put on Grant. It's 90 years since he was born, 20 years since he died. So let me just look at some of the things. I'll spend maybe 20 minutes on both thinkers, and it's not easy to sum up people of this caliber in 20 minutes, but in a short lecture, that's all I've got. George Grant came from probably one of the most important, high mucky-muck families in Canada. Historically, his grandfather was Principal Grant of Queen's University and Grant Hall at Queen's. Embodies and represents much of what he did. His other grandfather was George Parkin, who was at the center of the Rhodes Scholarship and started the Rhodes Scholarship. His father was a principal of Upper Canada College, one of the most important private schools in Toronto, that its whole purpose and raison d'etre, founded by Bishop John Strawn, was to create an intellectual elite in Canada that would stand for an Indigenous Canadian, Anglo-Canadian tradition in terms of questioning what was happening to the South in the United States. And so George Grant comes from that particular family background. His sister married George Ignatieff, and so most of you probably know the great Canadian George Ignatieff, and their son is Michael Ignatieff, who ran for the leadership of the Liberal Party. So when Michael Ignatieff was a young student at U of T, and particularly the 1960s, in the midst of the Vietnam War, Bob Ray and Michael Ignatieff were very good friends. They'd often phone Uncle George at McMaster, because he was one of the few academics in the 1960s that was challenging Canada's involvement in Vietnam, and particularly the American involvement in Vietnam. And so Grant would come and teach at the big sit-ins and teach-ins at U of T at the time that he was invited to attend by George or Michael Ignatieff. So he comes out of that tradition. His uncle is Vincent Massey, which is very important also to understand what launches George Grant in terms of very important as a public intellectual in Canada. So he comes from a family network or family connections in which he's almost sort of a well-heeled tradition in the sort of the leaders of Canadian intellectual public life in Canada. And many who took leading responsibilities in terms of the direction of Canada as a nation, at universities, what was going on, and publishing, and many other areas. After George Grant finished his doctoral studies at Oxford, where in fact this is where he initially met C.S. Lewis, George Grant and Sheila Grant initially met in the Socratic Club, that C.S. Lewis ran at Oxford. And a few years ago, when I was talking to Sheila Grant, she mentioned that C.S. Lewis's little book, The Abolition of Man, was a pivotal turning point for many at Oxford at the time, in which a form of relativism was running amok, and any sort of intellectual standards were being thinned out and dissipating like clouds in the skies. And Lewis's cogent argument in Abolition of Man held up standards that were certainly worth thinking through in the context of both Oxford and Cambridge at the time. George Grant, after he finished his PhD, he came to Dalhousie, and this is where he had one of his first great confrontations with probably one of the key philosophers in Canada at the time. Fulton Anderson was the head of philosophy at University of Toronto, and he had just published a book on Bacon, in which he had argued that the whole rise of the scientific world in the 16th century, the whole empirical way of knowing, was in many ways the way of the future for philosophy. And really it was the role of philosophy to be a handmaiden of science, both the way science came to know, and then much of Bacon's understanding of the new organum and the new Atlantis and all of this sort of thing. Grant, as a very young man at the time, dared to challenge this reigning monarch of the philosophic Sanhedrin in Canada. Fulton Anderson was so irritated and irate that this younger George Grant would dare to challenge him in his book, because George Grant also challenged Fulton Anderson's absolutely uncritical genuflecting to Bacon and Bacon's thinking and how it followed through in terms of what science as a way of knowing and technology that flowed from that. That he did what he could at that time at Dalhousie to get Grant out of his position as a professor of philosophy. This became much worse in the early 1950s when Grant's uncle, Vincent Massey, was asked to do the Massey Commission. After World War II, there was a great thinking going on in Canada. What does it mean to be a Canadian in the arts and the letters and the sciences? And it was quite a holistic way of rethinking Canadian identity. George Grant published his article in the Massey Commission called Philosophy, and in it he argued that much of modern philosophy had really become a dancing bear to science. It had lost its way, and rather than philosophy, which its rootedness was in the older contemplative traditions of Plato and Aristotle and Augustine and Bonaventura, it had given its way on the one hand to a scientific rationalism and empiricism, which just omitted some of the deepest elements of what it means to be human. And so this article came out. So in 1952, Fulton Anderson corralled all the philosophers in Canada. In 1952 conference, it was aimed at George Grant. And he became a persona non grata in Canada because he dared to go after those who were shaping and defining how you do philosophy. Throughout most of the 1950s, it's been argued that Northrop Frye and George Grant are probably, in particular in the CBC in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, were the two most prominent public intellectuals who could take all this big thoughts of the past and make it accessible, either through Massey lectures or variety ways. And between Northrop Frye and George Grant, they vied on CBC in terms of their lectures. So throughout much of the 1950s, George Grant gave a series of lectures, and it was his first book that was published called Philosophy in the Mass Age. As I mentioned earlier, Grant grew up in a family that was at the heart of progressive liberalism, the Grants, the Parkins. He was in the center of that sense that liberalism is the wave of the future, and how dare anyone question the essential premises of the Enlightenment project. It is the best and the brightest. And when he was at Dalhousie, he studied with a very important Canadian philosopher, James Dow. A Festschrift has just come out for James Dow. James Dow was a classics professor, and he was a Hegelian himself. And Hegel, as some of you know, argued that history is a story of the unfolding openness and consciousness to liberty and freedom. And so through a thesis, antithesis, synthesis, history is this unfolding growth in terms of our awakening of the consciousness of liberty and freedom. When Grant was as an undergrad at Queen's, he was a pallbearer for John Watson, who was the great Hegelian, who worked very closely with his grandfather, Principal Grant. So Grant was immersed. He was saturated. He was surrounded and enveloped by probably the greatest philosopher of modernity, Hegel, in many ways, and Hegel's understanding of the unfolding, the unorganic unfolding of history. Grant understood this well. He understood the premises of modernity, not so much the symptoms. He wanted to call forth the magus of modern thought and call it out of hiding, and he saw Hegel as the grand master of all of that thinking. In Philosophy in the Mass Age, which came out in the late 50s, he's going through a process in his thinking. Initially, he's on side that history is this organic unfolding into our consciousness of freedom, and that each and all in the historic unfolding of time are moving towards greater and greater understanding of liberty. Now, the content of liberty, of course, is never spelled out. The content of individuality is never spelled out, but the principle is the dominating vehicle driving this philosophic journey forward. But by the late 1950s, he's coming to question that. And if you read Philosophy in the Mass Age, you get this great contrast. But Grant is thinking through, on the one hand, the importance of natural law, natural theology. That in fact, there, in Plato, in the classics, in the ancients, there is a way of knowing, a way of being, that we come to know and attune ourselves to, that does not change. What Grant is going to be called the moving image of eternity. The moving image of eternity. So he comes to question by philosophy in the Mass Age this notion, and of course in the Hegelian journey, increasingly you leave behind the wisdom of the past, the insights of the past. It's what C.S. Lewis will call chronological snobbery. Why would you learn seriously about the past if in fact it is a lower level of knowing, a lower level of being, a lower level of understanding? The task is to get on the train of modernity and it will take you down the tracks into the future. By the late 50s, Grant is fairly well known as probably one of the better known public intellectuals through CBC. York University is just starting at the time. This is where he's going to have his clash with Fulton Anderson again. Because it was just in its first year or two, York, in its early courses, had to teach what U of T wanted in terms of doing philosophy. Grant was hired to head up the philosophy department, but Fulton Anderson stepped in. He said, if you're going to teach philosophy, you're going to teach it with the books I want, and the way I want, and the way I want, and the books I want, and you're going to be rather negative about Christianity and negative about Plato. And he wanted Grant to use a book of a friend of his, Marcus Long, who was very cynical of philosophy. And at the end of the day, philosophy just leads you, in a sense, to a place of cynicism and skepticism. Grant went to the new president of the university and he said, I'm not going to teach that way. He says, a philosopher should be able to think critically. And if you can't critique the spirit of liberalism, how critically are you doing philosophy? In short, if a liberal cannot critique liberalism, how liberal are they? For if at the heart of liberalism is critical thought, particularly emerging from the Enlightenment, surely you can critique the premises of liberalism. And if you can't, then liberalism becomes its own new fundamentalism. This is at the heart of Grant's thinking. He dared to interrogate the modern premises. He dared to interrogate liberalism at its very core and center by asking the question, what is the very source and center of liberalism? Don't go after its symptoms. Don't go after its fruit. Get the root. Because once you've got the root, you know the fruit that's going to come. Once you know the seed, you know what's going to emerge, just as in an old Aristotelian tradition. The acorn will produce the oak tree. Know the acorn, the premises of the acorn, and you'll understand. So, this great clash, and this is what George Grant finally said, if I cannot teach what I want in terms of the breadth of philosophy and allowing the ancients to critique the moderns and the moderns to interrogate the ancients, then I'm going to resign. He was one of the first to be hired at York and one of the first to leave. He had 6 children at the time, so it was a rather heroic move to leave York University in the first year with 6 children. It was after that they were starting a serious religious studies department at McMaster University, and George Grant was asked to be the first chair of the religious studies. And George Grant, for him, religious studies, when I did my doctoral studies at McMaster, religious studies was not taught in a narrow understanding of religious studies. You would study Plato and Aristotle and Seneca and Cicero and Augustine and Bonaventure and Ambrose and Macrina. You'd go through the whole tradition. It was political, it was theological, it was philosophical, it was literary. It was the old humanist tradition And of course, George Grant comes out of that particular heritage. George Grant dropped a bomb in 1965 on the Canadian public in his great work, Lament for a Nation, The Defeat of Canadian Nationalism. He had pleaded in 1963 in Canada when the Pearson government threatened to bring down the Diefenbaker government. He phoned Tommy Douglas, who was the head of the new NDP at that time. He said, don't vote with Pearson to bring down the Diefenbaker government, because Pearson is really going to be a dancing bear to Kennedy. Grant at that time had worked very, very closely with the NDP, or the CCF, and then the NDP. Tommy Douglas voted with Pearson to bring down the Diefenbaker government in 1963. Kennedy was very involved in undermining Diefenbaker. He sent up a lot of his key people to make Diefenbaker look antediluvian in many ways, and dated. It was out of that George Grant's book, Lament for a Nation, was written, The Defeat of Canadian Nationalism. And the book follows it's almost like a modern Jeremiah, lamenting the passing away of a philosophic way of being. So is he a beautiful loser? Who knows? He used the image that there was an older way of knowing and being that was about identity, it was about culture, it was about what it means to be human, it was about the arts, it was about politics. And he was lamenting philosophically, in a literary, political, economic way, the passing away of that. He compared it to a child you once had and you loved, and the child dies. You lament the passing of a good. He also used the image in Lament for a Nation of a fish that needs its water. And when you take the older water, or the water of the older way, away from the fish gasps at last and finally dies, because the water it needs, the great vision it needs to survive, is now gone. The book is considered to this day one of the classic meditations of Canadian political, philosophic, and theological thought. He starts from history, he examines the two parties, liberalism and conservatism, and then he moves on to examine conservative philosophy and liberal philosophy, and then he moves up higher and does theology. So it's the old classical, what we would call the ascent to truth. He starts with history. He doesn't do theory separate from history. He starts with a concrete reality. He explores the parties, the philosophy in the parties that causes them to move in very different directions, and then he ends with theology itself. So it's one of these, it's done in a very compact way. It's less than 100 pages, but there's so much packed into every line. I've taught the book probably now for 20 years. And every time students, we almost take 2 weeks per chapter to go through it bit by bit. And but at the end of it, they know the difference between what we would call the ancients, its understanding of the self, society, theology, environment, and we know the difference between that and the liberal attitudes. Grant is very interesting in that when he looks at the roots of what we call the modern liberal way, there's a form of Christianity that wants to argue liberalism begins in the Enlightenment. Grant will say, interestingly enough, following C.S. Lewis on this, that no. The modern mood began with the Protestant Reformation. Where was individualism set free? When was the genie taken out of the bottle? When was individuality set free and conscience? Well, certainly at the center of the Protestant Reformation is each claiming the liberty, in good conscience, to use their freedom as they see fit, either before God, the Spirit, or sola scriptura. And although you have the formal principle of the Bible, the real authority for the Protestant reformers, Grant will argue, as does C.S. Lewis, was in fact the principles of liberty, equality, conscience, freedom, individuality. They're all there. You read Luther's Liberty of the Christian Man, and you read all of these people. They're appealing to what today we would call essential liberal premises. And so he would argue, when he had to engage many Christians at the time, he would say, stop blaming the Enlightenment for the problems. In fact, you are the ones who let the genie out of the bottle. And the Enlightenment is just building and fleshing out those principles in all sorts of new directions. So the roots of modernity are in fact the Reformation. That's why Grant philosophically was Catholic, essentially. Busy because he saw Protestantism really as the source of the fragmentation that we see today on a whole range of ways. 1969, he was asked to give the Massey Lectures called Time is History. Now the question he asked, who are a few of the great critics of modernity? Remembering Grant is teaching at a public university, McMaster University, so he can't, as if he was teaching in a seminary and Bible school, use the Bible. So he picks up the two great critics of modernity, Friedrich Nietzsche and later Martin Heidegger, in his thinking. I'll actually be living at Friedrich Nietzsche's home this summer up in where four of his books came out of, in the Engadine region of Switzerland in Seals Marina. Some of his collection is there that is nowhere else. Grant saw in Nietzsche and Heidegger, and if I had the time here, and as he was dying, he was writing a work, in fact, on Christianity and Heidegger. It was in Nietzsche and Heidegger they came as the great critics of the modern world, questioning rationalism, calling people back to a contemplative way of knowing, critiquing what Nietzsche calls the last man. What liberalism was producing was people that essentially were going to be well-fed, well-fattened, but they had no chests anymore. Where was the passion? In fact, Taylor will pick this up in his Malaise too. And he says, liberalism gives you much, but at the end of it, he said, what you have is intimations of deprival. You've got everything, but at a deeper level, you seem to have nothing. And you've got to listen to those intimations of deprival that are going on. So Grant turned in his thinking increasingly back of the Reformation, back of Hegel, who was, in one sense, one of the great gods of modern philosophic thought, increasingly to Plato. Because Plato gave him the philosophic language to think about the issues in a way the Bible didn't and couldn't, because it's a revelatory tradition, not as much a reflective tradition. And he argued you had to be bilingual. You had to understand the language of your faith tradition, but you also had to understand the philosophic premises of the world in which you lived. And of course, being at McMaster, which is a public university, you have to understand the great thinkers of the time. And he would often turn one against another. And it was always fascinating in classes the way he would bring all these modern thinkers and have one challenge the other. So a Nietzsche and a Heidegger would be used to critique a Kant and a Hegel. And then he would use someone else to critique Nietzsche and Heidegger. And it was a gradual. His apologetics were very, very sophisticated. Often find interesting when people are interested in Christian apologetics and they ignore Grant. Grant is one of the most sophisticated apologists there is in terms of how he thinks through things and finally presents the Christian vision. His great work, George and I were just talking about it before, in the early 1970s, English Speaking Justice is where he goes after probably one of the greatest of American liberals, Rawls. And in that, he fleshes out in the clearest possible way the premises of liberalism and exposes them for what they are. And he asks, then, can a liberal critique liberalism? And if they can't, how liberal is that liberal? And because Rawls was such a prominent American, well, not only just American, but beyond that, he thought he wanted to go after the Goliaths of the time. And he did. And it's a very, very important work, English Speaking Justice. He left McMaster in 1980, it's hard to say, and there's so much to grant. This is sort of a whistle-stop tour. So he left McMaster in 1980 over the big issue of, he was being pressed, as many academics are, was publish, 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 get more articles, get more books out. And he was feeling, as a teacher, his primary task was to awaken students in terms of a quest for wisdom, philosophy in that old sense. Not knowledge, facts, statistics, but the love of wisdom, and above all, the love of love itself, which is at the heart of Plato's thought in the Symposium in the Phaedrus, and of course the book of John and St. Paul. And so you get this, Grant is really returning to what we call the older patristic vision and tradition in Canada that lasted from the second to the seventh centuries, in which the classics, the classical Christian tradition, brought together the Jewish heritage and the Greek and the Roman tradition in one grand synthesis that built a huge civilization. It was out of that that Christendom emerged. These people didn't shrink from learning or thinking or philosophy. They went right into the center of it and engaged the big issues in a very thoughtful way. So he left McMaster, went back to Dalhousie, spent the last 8 years there, and his home became a bit of a shrine. Last time I was there on Walnut Street, I had been a lovely afternoon with his wife, Sheila Grant. She's in her late 80s now. She was just as brilliant as he. And some of the articles Grant wrote, in fact, his wife wrote them. He got credit for them, a couple of fine articles in Dostoevsky. And again, Dostoevsky was a great thinker of thinking through classical Russian orthodoxy and Russian nationalism. And so he had a great affinity to orthodoxy and Dostoevsky and also Tolstoy in his thinking. There's much more I could say about Grant, but at the heart of his thinking is that there are two great philosophic systems at work. That is, there are the ancients, in which the ancients believed there was an order to the universe, to the cosmos. And the task of being human was, on the one hand, to know that order, and on the other hand, to live from that order, to attune ourselves to it and to live it. That was never an easy task. It was a lifelong journey. And he was keenly aware of that. But he started from the classical notion that all things had a nature, ephusis, all things had an end, telos, or teleology. And the task of philosophy was to unearth in each person what their potential might be and lead them through the great virtues, prevent them from taking the dead ends of the vices, and then the reform of the human soul and mind and society. And so education and politics were all basic to his thinking through how the ancients understood life. So if you study at McMaster, you do Republic, you do the Laws, you do the Gorgias, you do the Statesman. You'd be studying Aristotle and the great classical understanding and how Augustine synthesized all of that. And more importantly for Grant, because he detested scholars who didn't integrate their thinking into the real world. He called that museum culture, or dead archivists. Grant was always interested in the shuttling back and forth between the wisdom of the past and the ongoing relevance for the present. And if it doesn't speak to us, then what's the purpose of it other than just as a dry archivist? If it doesn't speak to the quest to live more meaningfully, to be wiser, and to engage more justly in the world, and learning itself can become an opiate in that sense. Interestingly enough, he died in 1988 when he shifted. He was a great supporter of Diefenbaker and the Conservative Party. And this, of course, gives in Canada, we have shifted, and I'll just move away from Grant after that. Since Brian Mulroney came to power, our understanding of conservatism has essentially become American Republican. That is not the conservatism of a Stephen Leacock, a George Grant, a John Strawn, Susanna Moody. There's a whole range of Canadians. When you read, for example, Grant's Lament for a Nation, and if you were to look at Stephen Harper or Brian Mulroney's understanding of conservatism, you just realize you're not in Kansas anymore. We're in two different worlds here. One very, very much reflects American Republican thinking. And probably two important works, one that was written 2 years after Lament for a Nation, was the Manning Dynasty in Alberta. Preston Manning did the research for his father, Ernest Manning, Political Realignment. And that tradition coming out of Alberta that calls itself conservatism really is just an echo of American Republicanism. Two important Canadian works in political thought, theological thought, social thought. Lament for a Nation, 65, Political Realignment, 67. You get the cleavage already at work. And of course, the Manning tradition has largely won at the present time. History always reverses itself again and again, but we happen to be in a phase when republicanism is in the dominance right now. Grant is a wonderful way to think conservative without going into republicanism, because of course republicanism itself is a form of liberalism, what we call first generation liberalism. Charles Taylor, let me just shift here. I wrote Taylor in the early 90s and I said, if I can summarize your work without being somewhat trite or silly in a paragraph, tell me if I'm right or wrong. I said, what you're attempting to do, I said, you're attempting to rescue the Enlightenment project in its complex nature, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, against its distortions and against the classical or the ancients. And I said, the way I understand what you're trying to do is this. In the Enlightenment of the 17th, 18th, early 19th century, three ways of thinking emerged. What you call the right wing of the Enlightenment emphasized rationalism as a way of knowing, empiricism as the means of justifying and falsifying what can be known or not known, and that form of science emerged out of what we call the right wing, and people like a Hawkins and a Christopher Hitchens and these people all come out of what you call the right wing side of the Enlightenment, in which hard, logical reasons, premises, conclusions, empiricism, verification, falsification, that's the only thing that's acceptable in the sanctuary, the intellectual sanctuary. The reaction to what we would call the rationalist wing in the Enlightenment, which was still part of the Enlightenment, is what we call the romantic wing of the Enlightenment, in which poetry, intuition was held high. Metaphor, narrative, story, personal experience. What Taylor is trying to do, as Hegel tried to do, is to say, listen, there is good in the rational, empirical way of knowing, but it can lead to rationalism or scientism, which then blinds you to some of the deepest things in life. Because if you can't verify or falsify something empirically, does that mean it's not real? Well, certain things we all know are subjectively real. We know through different ways and means. So Taylor turned to the right, as did Hegel in his time, and said, what is the good in the empirical, rational way of knowing, but what is the limitation of that way of knowing? What does it reveal? What does it conceal? The romantics, an intuitive way of knowing, the subjective way of knowing, the poetic, the literary way of knowing, what is the good in that, but what is the limitation of that? The humanist wing of the Enlightenment, which is the centrist wing of the Enlightenment, tried to bring the best out of what we call the right and the left wing of the Enlightenment, the rational and the poetic. It also tried to balance individualism with community. Right-wing Hegelianism, which you probably a few years ago, Francis Fukuyama was big on that and arguing the end of history, was arguing we've come to the end of history not in terms of facts or information, but in terms of the premises. There are no more battles to be fought at the level of premises. Liberty, individualism, freedom, conscience, those are the creeds. They're the Athanasian Nicene Creed of the modern world. Our task is then just to flesh that out in terms of application. So Charles Taylor in the 1950s, he does much of his studies. He began at McGill. McGill was a bastion of a lot of left-wing thought at the time. I'm the political science advisor to the Stephen Leacock home in Ontario, and Stephen Leacock taught political science. Most of you might know him as a writer of humor and novels, but his best-selling books were in political science and political economy. And he was head of political science at McGill. And it's out of there, some of the most interesting Canadian political theorists and activists emerged, like David Lewis, who was founder, key figure in CCF, Eugene Forsey, Frank Scott, all these people. Many were students of Stephen Leacock at McGill at the time. Here's an interesting thing in Canada. Here you have a Tory, like Stephen Leacock, and like George Grant, but the left is very drawn to them at certain points. Now, you can't imagine that in republicanism. This is something distinctive in the Canadian tradition, which we call our red Toryism. And the Leacock and Grant family were very good friends also. So we have this older Toryism that begins with the common weal, the common good, important roles of the state in protecting certain basic things. But Charles Taylor, so he comes out of the Quebec experience, political science. He did his work in history at McGill, then he goes on to do the rest of his degrees in the 1950s in England. He plays a very prominent role in England in the New Left. I don't know if many of you have read much of Isaiah Berlin. There's a beautiful picture in Michael Ignatieff's biography of Berlin. You can see the tousle-haired Taylor, a part of the group, the younger part. But he's very much emerges out of a very thoughtful yet agonizing liberalism that Isaiah Berlin came to represent. That he thought this was the best way to go, and yet there were real problems built into the very structure of liberalism that liberalism itself couldn't answer. And you get this agonizing in Taylor himself. In that sense, he becomes an interesting apologist for something bigger than the Enlightenment, and yet he wants to stay in it. In his book, like Malaise and Modernity, which is a Reader's Digest for Sources of the Self, you're in a malaise. What do you do? It's like Grant's Intimations of Deprival. Taylor then does most of his formal education at Oxford in England. He then comes to Canada, full of the brightest enthusiasm, wanting to link, and this is where he and Grant share things, link thought and action, public intellectual and serious academic work. So he becomes very, very involved in the NDP. He runs four times in federal election. In fact, he runs against Pierre Trudeau once in federal election. In 1963, it was Trudeau who urged Taylor to run, and then he ran against Trudeau. And he lost, of course. But throughout most of the 1960s, he's at the center of what we would call the social democratic tradition in Canada. And this was his major book that came out called The Pattern of Politics, 1970, in which he's arguing a strong left-wing Hegelianism. Of course, that's not clearly articulated in this book. It's going to come a little later. Because Hegelian thought can go in one of three directions. It can go strong on the individual's quest for liberty. It can go in the argument to the left, which Marx was going to pick up on, is that the freedom of each can only be fulfilled when the freedom of all is fulfilled. Hence, you need a strong communal political philosophy. And then Marx will draw to that. And then there's the centrist Hegelian tradition. Taylor is going to argue very, very clearly, particularly in his activism and in this book, is that authentic Canadian political thought and activism is essentially a centrist form of Hegelian thought that blends the individual and community, the role of the state, and you can't go way off into the liberal individualism. We'll find later, particularly in Malaise Moderni, why Taylor critiques postmodern thought. Because he feels it is an aberration of the Enlightenment humanist synthesis. He's trying to hold together individual and community, rationalism and intuition, a whole range of tensions, and he will argue in Malaise and Moderni that in fact, in postmodern thought, the individualistic side is running away from the community, away from responsibility, and it priorizes, it almost idolizes the self, which doesn't even know what the self is at a certain point. It's an open-ended notion. It's in the 1970s which Charles Taylor emerges on the Canadian scene as not only an important activist, but the primary scholar, or one of the primary scholars in Canada, of Hegel. He does two key works that establish him very clearly as one of the dominant Canadian Hegelian thinkers. 1975 Hegel, and then in 1979 Hegel and Modern Society. He's given himself fully at this point to fleshing out Hegel's main arguments that the flow of history is ever forward and it is the unfolding of our consciousness of liberty and freedom. But like Hegel, he's going to argue, beware of the right wing of the Enlightenment and the left wing, and it's the humanist wing of the Enlightenment he's going to uphold. But he's still going to hold to Enlightenment premises of liberty, individuality, conscience, and the freedom of the individual to find their own happiness as they see fit. This is going to be the heart of his work in the 90s. What are the sources of the self? Where do we even get our notion? He's gradually moving away from politics, both theoretically and practically, and he's beginning to ask the questions about the self. Where do we even get our notions of who we are, how we are to live, what it means to be human? He's probing those tough questions that liberals, in a meaningful sense, have to ask. And what are those sources? Where do they even come from? And any thoughtful person is always grappling with that. How do I know the right from the wrong? How do I know even who I am? Now, the classical tradition answered that question very differently. It was about knowing yourself, but how did you know yourself? And what were the means of knowing the self? And how did education and a variety of other means assist a person in knowing who they are, how they are to live, so when they got to the end of the trail in their life's journey, they look back and say, I have lived in a meaningful manner, or an authentic or genuine manner. So by the 1990s, Taylor is shifting, and it's interesting, this is a great shift of his from the 60s and the 70s, where social criticism is very important. When I was at McMaster, Gadamer was there. George Grant often brought Gadamer there. And the relationship to Gadamer and Taylor is a very important one, particularly the issue of what's called hermeneutical generosity, which means you're essentially trying to be open to a variety of perspectives, hear things from a variety of perspectives. But living in that tension is no easy, because if you're starting from a position of a social critic and committed to a political philosophic position, at a certain point you stop your listening and say, this is the way it is. The NDP is the answer, as it were. But once you do the hermeneutical generosity, then there are no final stances to take. There's just empathy, there's listening, there's attempt to understand. And one of Taylor's PhD students, Ronnie Biner, has done a very, very good article looking at the shift in Taylor's thinking from the time when he was engaged with the issues, he was committed to things, particularly parties, and the way as he's moved into the hermeneutical tradition, he finds it hard to be committed to anything other than just listening to different perspectives and trying to bridge solitudes and legitimate a pluralism without. So pluralism itself becomes a new absolute. George Grant once said, the rhetoric of pluralism obscures the monistic fact. The monistic fact at the heart of all that is liberal principles you can't question. So what you get in Charles Taylor, essentially, his thinking is he sees the limitations, the weaknesses of the classical way, the classical Christian. This is the irony, of course, he's Catholic. But he's a liberal Catholic, or is he a Catholic liberal? Which comes first in Taylor? That's the interesting question. He's accepted as a philosopher. He's not going to do theology, particularly, because that's crossing a bridge. Grant will do theology in a public university. He's told he's not supposed to, but he'd say, what kind of liberalism is that, that you can't teach theology? In the name of liberalism, in terms of which is supposed to be an open-mindedness, you're becoming more closed-minded all the time. You're just excluding and excluding and excluding large elements of human experience. So Grant was the great apologist for an organic way of understanding life. Taylor himself becomes really a sophisticated apologist for the modern world. And what's interesting is that as a philosopher, I've always seen the role of philosophy to ask critical questions. And I would think the most important thing a philosopher can do today is ask critical questions about the premises of modernity. And yet that's forbidden and censored out in many places. In that sense, Grant is a prophetic philosopher, and Taylor becomes an assimilation accommodationist in a sophisticated way. But it's a bit like, some of you know, I'll conclude with this story. Some of you know the story of the frog in the pot. And if you put a frog in a boiling pot, it will leap out immediately. If you put a frog in a warm pot and gradually warm it up, the frog will fall asleep and die. Interestingly asked about Taylor is how much of his thinking is about warming the pot so we fall asleep into the embrace of modernity and doing it in a very sophisticated way. I think Grant can come as a good critic of Taylor because many genuflect before Taylor today. And he's become a key mentor or guide, North Star, Polaris for many. But who are the critics of Taylor? I think Grant can come and give a very, very interesting way of asking the question about the premises of liberalism, asking them to come from their hiding, their obscurity, and ask questions about them. And it's in that dialogue between the ancients and the moderns. I think we have a much more vibrant intellectual life rather than the classics being dismissed and the modern being elevated and put on a throne as the reigning monarch that no one dare question at all, must genuflect intellectually before. Enough said. Any questions? The rhetoric of pluralism legitimates the monistic fact. The rhetoric of pluralism legitimates the monistic fact in technology and empire. Is that we hear a lot about pluralism and openness, but how open are we to critique the premises of liberalism itself? Because pluralism is just an outworking of the premises of liberalism. But can you critique the premises of liberalism itself? And that's where Grant argues we have a monism at the center of our culture that the leading intellectuals will not touch. It's the taboo. You become excommunicated from the clan if you do. And he certainly felt the wrath of it again and again in his life.
Thanks for your lecture. I think it's an incredibly, provocative lecture. I may come out way through Taylor's Secular Age, which is quite a task. And there are many things that, many questions that I want to ask, but just one. What would be your understanding of the relationship between what you're calling the premises of liberalism and what Taylor argues for in the Secular Age? About the conditions of thought itself, it seems to me that if you placed your analysis of liberalism in dialogue with his understanding of not just liberalism or Marxism, but the way in which we are able to think, given the unfolding of history, given the situation that we're presently in,
What would you see as that in Taylor? Because one of the things Grant will argue, particularly going from Heidegger earlier, his time in history is, and the historicism is, there's a certain form of liberalism that argues we are historic beings, and we can never know anything outside of our situatedness or our thrownness in time. And hence, to say to some degree, we can pierce the heavens to something higher and articulate a good that we can all agree upon. Most modern philosophy will deny that because of our situatedness historically. And so we have to work with our historicity, our trappedness in time, and our fragmentation of that, and just separate perceptions. And we all perceive things differently. And Taylor's trying to articulate a way, the best way forward, given the fact we are historic beings. And we can't go back to an understanding of a way of knowing the classical, but we want to avoid even more fragmentation in our culture, postmodern. What are your thoughts?
That would be my argument. The American sociologist, Peter Berger, a number of his works, I was just reading a book he wrote a few years ago, and where he uses the expression of plausibility structures.
Sure, yeah.
And And I think this question that it links to the question that Taylor poses, that why was it easy to believe in God in 1500? Why is it so difficult in the period that we're in?
Yeah.
And I think that the kind of analysis that you're making of liberalism or simply calling it a kind of nostalgic way for a return to sort of grand organicism just, to me, is not penetrating and deep enough in analysis.
Well, what do you think might be, though? No, when I get that question thrown my way, it's as if we can't question liberalism. We cannot question rationalism. We cannot. That is the alpha and omega as a way of knowing. What might be some of the limitations? This is a question where, what might be some of the limitations of liberalism? And if a liberal can't ask that question, are they not trapping? First of all, there are consequences, which Taylor's going to note, in malaise as you feel that, you know. I think Taylor, at the best, he's trying to say, we're trapped as historic beings. We can't go back, and yet we feel this sense of longing, this malaise, this we don't know what to do with it. And perhaps the longing itself is a signal that perhaps the premises we accepted are faulty, and we need to puncture them. Go back to Leonard Cohen, Beautiful Losers. It's in the cracks that the light gets in, you know. And this is what Grant's trying to get to. So my concern when people raise that, it's nostalgia. No, it's not going back. It's trying to be open to something bigger that the soul hungers and pants for. And it can't be satisfied with the thin food that's being put on the intellectual banquet table today. And just by looking at the consequences of what we're having to live with, that itself should be a sign or a signal that something's not right in society, the soul, and in the soil itself.
Thank you for your lecture. I enjoyed it very much. And to the degree I understood it, I agree 100% with the thrust of it. The problem I'm having with it is I'd like to go back to your frog in the pot. And that's a very powerful image. And I think Taylor needs to be represented a little better when that kind of thing is put upon. My sense in reading Taylor, I'm new to Grant, but everything that's said makes me think I side more of Grant. But it just seems the notion with Taylor pivots on two things. One, this idea of what is here, that must be. So let's not cry about it, let's deal with it. So let's give him that, that his premise is a very Christian premise. It's a knowledge of it's all the will of God, and let's accept it, and we as humans, let's work through that premise. If you go back to the ancient, my major understanding of it is one of the key differences is polis, the idea that it's not self, it's not individual, that's even a foreign concept. It's how the individual exists amongst others in the city, in the polis. I think Taylor might well be saying something to the effect that if we understand ourselves as individuals in the midst of this globalism, we may discover polis again, we may discover community again. And so let's go deeper into our dilemma. Let's go deeper into our dilemma. And while I don't disagree at all, nor do I think Taylor would disagree with what you're saying, that Grant wanted, it's how we get community again. I think that's my understanding.
Well, yeah, and I think certainly Taylor's writings in the 90s has turned from an extreme individualism to communitarianism. It is an attempt to say in liberalism you have to balance the liberal and community, but it does not give the content of either the individual or the community how they're going to make it. And that's the dilemma of liberalism. It will posit principles, but it shies away very quickly from giving any content to the principles themselves. And certainly from the classical, he is struggling, and to his credit, and I think he must be honored for this, he is doing a great battle against postmodern individualism. And all the great communitarian thinkers are doing that. They say with the breakdown of community and the fragmentation, you get loneliness, you get separation, you get bewilderment, you get people hidden down paths that are cul-de-sacs. And he said it's in the connection between individual and community that in fact there is a way forward. The question is, what is the way forward once you bring them together? Because it's an open-ended notion of individual and community. So I think the classical understanding of political theory in the self is much more sophisticated. You can say, yes, they belong together. It's like the It's the Pauline image of the body of Christ, or Plato uses exactly the same thing in the Republic, that the individual is only fulfilled, and Paul uses the image in Corinthians, is when you're knit together, the hand, the arm, the body, it finds its fulfillment. Each of our uniqueness only finds its fulfillment in the good of the whole. And I think the classical understanding of individual, community, polis, is quite different from the modern. And that would take us into a... But, I mean, your questions you're raising are so important.
Yes. I have before me a short article about Taylor. The other end, ourselves, is multiculturalism inherently relativist. And he begins by looking at relativism and seeing it as a danger, mm-hmm. that it will undermine our values. And then he carries on and says we can never discover species-wise laws because we can never operate outside of our historically and culturally specific understanding. So then it seems to give into relativism at that point. And I've read him, and I don't see that he shows a way out of it.
It's a dilemma. I mean,
but in this monistic liberalism, is there a sort of a core of implicitly shared values that one might find in Taylor's thought, even though he can't explicitly articulate it for some reason?
Well, I think what he's trying to do, in one sense, rightly so, saying there has been a danger in Western thought that we have demeaned the important role of the individuality, creativity, insight. This is where the romantic tradition comes along. It's called authentic, the quest for the authentic self. He's right. And there's always the danger in sometimes when you uphold order or community that sometimes the individual can get crushed. The reaction to that, though, is to say, and there is this danger of saying community, order is repressive. The only way to go for authenticity is individualism. Well, then the question you ask, what's the problem of individualism? If you're only going to demonize the one and idealize the other, you've got real problems. And so often what's argued is that pluralism is the answer out of relativism. Is it? But that's held. And what do you mean by plural? What do you mean by pluralism? And there's obviously good pluralism. There's problematic. But what's the line there? And Taylor's grappling with that, and he's honestly grappling with that.
Well, can't somebody come back to Taylor and say, well, pluralism means a lot of different views, and so what you believe is relative to your group or your cultural subculture, so that's just another form of relativism.
From the premises of liberal, I mean, his struggle in Quebec is one of, I mean, because on one hand you have to honor a certain form of pluralism. And pluralism is a reality, and you have to honor certain elements. It's grappling with English-speaking Canada, French-speaking Canada. Differences of individuals, they're legitimate. But at what point does that lead to a fragmentation? It's a razor's edge you're on, and it's a very important razor's edge.
That's not... If I could take the privilege of chair here, putting a question in, but has not Taylor, using the metaphor we've heard, been thrown into the pot, the hot pot, broiling pot, with the challenge not so much of Christianity, but of Islam, to a culture in Quebec which is still recovering from the great... changes of the Quiet Revolution, but has not, I mean, I admire him for taking on this challenge, and he's going to have to come out with solutions here. Wouldn't it have been wonderful if George Grant could have been co-chair of this Commission on Accommodation in Quebec? But could you speak a little bit about how you see philosophy and faith contributing to the dilemmas and challenges of making up pluralism in Canada, in Quebec, right now?
Well, I think there's a few things that have to go work. One is at a theoretical level. Philosophers, if they're going to take critical thinking seriously, have to ask questions about the premises of liberalism. At a practical level, I think you have to ask the question, what is the validity of pluralism and what's the limitation of pluralism? Because pluralism pushed too far can legitimate all sorts of social expressions which divide and create not two solitudes, McLennan style, but multiple solitudes. And so on the one hand, you have to honor a certain form. It's a type of pluralism you have to honor, and a certain pluralism that leads to multiple solitudes. Relativism, of course, just perpetuates a certain form of liberalism. I think Taylor is doing his best to say, listen, this is what we live in. These are the premises of modernity. You can't fight them. It's like there's a picture of Alec Colville, one of the great Canadian painters. He's got this train coming down the track. He's got this wolf standing it. And he painted it for George Grant. He says, Grant, you're the wolf. The train is coming down, and you're standing there like a King Canute. Has Taylor taken the position that liberalism is all we've got? You've got to start, that's the alpha and omega. You can't work outside of that. So how do we make the best within it? But why can't you question it? I mean, critical thinkers, it's so much the spirit of an age. Same as Hegel. Of course, you don't question it. That's what it is. But to me, it's, as I've said earlier, if a liberal can't critique liberalism, how liberal are they? And I would think, as critical thinkers, that has to...
I think to speak to this issue of pluralism and Taylor, we have to give him some credit. He's not a relativist.
No.
And he does believe in a hierarchy of the goods. And he does draw on the ancients to some extent. He's been influenced by people like Iris Murdoch and others in Oxford, as Grant has, on the idea of the good. I think one of the things I've seen about Taylor in his response to the situation, he does see himself in the situation of pluralism, of plurality. What he's trying to avoid, he's looking at how we see ourselves, and he says we often identify ourselves with some good, often what he calls a hyper-good. Gives us a basic identity. And that's what's in conflict with one another in pluralism. What he doesn't want to do is allow one good to eat up all the others. That's the great crime, the great intellectual, political crime of the century for Taylor. Mm-hmm. What he wants to do is allow these tensions, and that's what he's doing in Quebec, allow a tension between these goods. And he says, you know, if you allow, you create a great evil if you allow one particular good, one person's identity, to swallow up all the others. And so that's what we're struggling with in Canadian society, is this question of what is our hyper good. And we're at war with each other, many, many different kinds of wars, over what is the most important good for us.
Yeah.
So I think this is the brilliance of Taylor.
He's
called us out into this particular arena. Yeah. This is us. This is what we're fighting with. We need to learn to negotiate these goods.
Yeah.
To me, that is the absolute brilliance of Taylor.
And that's,
he draws on the ancients. And what he meant is more than willing to mention the name of God in the sources of the self. So he's not totally a modernist in that sense. He escapes modernity through drawing on Augustine and others. That's his Catholicism coming in. So there is something of the ancient in Taylor. And there's maybe a little more common ground between Taylor and Grant.
I was going to say, your point is very well taken. That's straight Isaiah Berlin. You know, Berlin's argument is that the heart of liberalism is liberty, equality, fraternity. And you can't have one without the other. If you push one too far, you exclude or subordinate the other. If you push liberty, everyone fighting for the liberty, you get the clash. If you get solidarity, then people are repressed for the common good. And it's living in the tragedy of the tensions. And that's straight Isaiah Berlin and living with the youngster. But I think the future, particularly good philosophy in Canada, lives in the dialogue and trying to sort out Grant and Taylor. And there's been too many people who've gone Taylor and ignored Grant, and some people ignore Grant and do Taylor. But it's in that dialogue, in the best sense of the ancients. See, I would question Taylor's understanding of the ancients in his read of Augustine and sources of the self and a whole range of issues that he's made Augustine to something he's not. But I think in that dialogue, I think you got a healthy place for a vibrant philosophic grappling with issues. But Grant has tended to be subordinate, and Taylor at this point, halos put around him.
All right, it then remains for me to simply thank you very much for this beautiful lecture that has provoked us and informed us at the same time. If only we could find a conservative Tory philosopher king. It certainly wasn't McKinsey.
No.
Let me then also invite people to the next of the graduate and faculty from lectures when David Jeffrey from Baylor University will be with us, same time, same place, on the 2nd of February. And he will be speaking of the recovery of training in terms of the follow-up.